I exhaled, felt my lungs catch as if a tight band constricted them, and then my chest filled like a balloon. I became giddy with air. I floated on my back, rising and falling in a gentle swell, the sky above cloudless and blue. When I rose to the crest of the swell, I saw a sloping shore, dark brown and corrugated, capped by a thick brownish mist. In the water around me, tiny brown disks floated like chips of xyla. At first I thought they were remains of the Vigilant, but small piscids rose and plucked them from the surface, leaving spreading ripples across the smooth rolls of ocean. Still alive. Still breathing, still floating. None of it seemed real. With a lazy nonchalance, I turned over in the water and tried to look around. I could not remember at first what had happened. I knew there had been a ship and crewmates in the water, but nothing else seemed clear. I found the ship, the bowsprit and prow rising and bobbing in the water a dozen meters away, ropes dangling. Ridge gel had vanished from the bowsprit. Bits of wreckage slid down the gentle slopes of sea. I reached out for a long yard, perhaps from a lower topgallant, but it passed by and I could not grab it. A flat piece of xyla, part of a hatch cover, caught my attention, and I swam toward it, grabbing the frame and crawling halfway out of the water. It made a fair raft, 2 meters on a side, two edges chewed, but floating even under my weight. Memory came back as I realized I did not need to die soon. I thought of Sherla, and clumsily pushed up onto my knees on the chewed hatch cover, shielding my eyes against the sun's glare. A body floated face down about 30 meters away on the other side of the ship's bow and the swaying bowsprit. I recognized the thick shoulders and short hair of Talia Rydium. I moaned and turned again, hoping to see someone alive. I looked back at what Salop had called the caudal end of the storm. More wreckage drifted in that direction, a trail of broken planks, snake's nest rigging, a few round objects that were either fiddle blocks or dead eyes, or bobbing heads. I tried to get to my feet, but the hatch cover tilted dangerously and I fell back on hands and knees. "Sherla!" I yelled. "Salop! Captain! Anybody?" Two or three weak voices answered, among them a woman, too hoarse to identify immediately. I grabbed a splintered Lisbu plank and began to paddle toward the bobbing heads. Awkwardly, I whirled this way and that until I found the best part of the hatch cover to assign as a bow. The storm still filled the eastern horizon, columns of brown mist rising in air currents, parting in distinct streams and being sucked back into gray masses of clouds on either side. It was about 6 miles away. I rowed and watched the remaining brown disks being plucked from the surface by stray scions, and tried to piece together what had happened, how we had survived, but my thinking was too ragged. 3 people hung along the length of a slender skysail yard. They could not all rest their weight on the yard or it would sink, so 2 were swimming and a 3rd was resting. They called to me hoarsely, voices mere squeaks above the slosh and hiss of the wreckage in the gentle waves.
"Oh, me,"
said one, and left the yard to swim toward my hatch cover. I saw it was Shatro and was very disappointed. But then I saw Sherla clinging to the yard, her face smeared with brown, hair in sticky strands, but alive, and I welcomed Shatro aboard as if we were the best of friends. Together we paddled with hands and the single plank toward the yard, and Salop, wearing only black pants, swam weakly toward one side of the hatch. Sherla held out one arm and I pulled her onto the other side. 4 were too many and the hatch began to founder, so I jumped into the water and let them settle themselves as best they could while I clung to one side. We were all too exhausted and emotionally drained to say much. Sherla took hold of my hand and patted it, looking at me with wide, haunted eyes and a weak smile.
"Where?"
she said, and coughed. "Wherever," I answered. Shatro stared over our heads blankly.
"Have you seen Randall or the captain?" Salop managed to ask, balancing himself half on, half off the unstable raft.
"No," I said.
"The others," Salop said, "they might have been swallowed." "We were spat out," Shatro said. "I saw it. The wall broke in 2 and let us slip through." Not before it ate our ship, Shirla said. A tiny morsel it did not want, Salop said.
Resting on the hatch cover, breathing for once without swallowing water, they seemed to revive a little. The water was cooling rapidly in the wake of the storm. Soon it would be chilly. The sun, on the other hand, was brilliant and would soon toast us. Salop studied the departing mass of clouds with half-closed eyes.
The whole expedition, he said,
and shook his head, his face hard and eyes narrowed. For a long time nobody said anything. I tried to feel something, grief or elation at having survived, but my thoughts were jumbled, and I felt nothing clearly.
Where now?
Shirla asked again.
Nowhere, Shatro said.
From a few dozen meters away another voice called. With a sudden burst of energy, we arranged ourselves to swim and push the hatch cover toward the new voice. Erwin Randall clung to a large piece of hull, 5 meters long and 2 meters across, still attached to several ribs. This floated planks up, and he lay flat on it. With a quick reconnoiter, we lashed the hatch cover to the larger piece of hull and all climbed from the water.
The captain's dead, Randall said. I saw his body before the storm spat us out.
Salop rubbed his cheeks wearily with his palms and nodded, downturned lips and deep black eyes, asking without words, what is there to be done? We lay back to contemplate our last hours in this or any world. Night came as a great relief. We were very thirsty, and the sun only made our condition worse. We bobbed gently under the pure welded metal smear of sunset in a cloudless twilight sky, the water splashing us, stinging cold at first, then numbing. Salop and Shirla slept for a while. A few small meteors lanced the starry night. I felt dead weary but not sleepy. I realized with a calming certainty that we were as isolated as could be, on a sparsely populated world, and that death was the only likely outcome. Randall did not agree, however. He responded to my unspoken gloomy certainty with,
"You know, there's still the steamships,"
Shatro grumbled. I did not want to argue the point. My mouth was dry and my tongue stuck to the roof so tightly that I thought I might choke. The ocean waters of Lamarckia were notoriously drying. Potassium salts and other minerals crusted on my legs and arms.
"We could catch a scion," Randall continued, his words thick. "We really should paddle around and look for others."
I made no response. We had no tools, no bait a scion would go for. All the brown disks left by the storm had been gobbled before nightfall. We could have eaten them ourselves had we had the presence of mind to scoop a few out of the waves.
"Thirsty," Shatro murmured.
He curled up on the far end and slept, snoring loudly in bursts every few minutes. I had heard that disaster bred a wonderful clarity of thought. All I felt was layers of thick, tangled fuzz pulled through my brain. I would die comfortably enough. As I was too dumb to remember anything, death would merely snuff a dull instant of unconnected being. Olmi was already gone. I gave little thought to my responsibilities back on Thistledown. Family, Nexus, the Hexamon itself, secret duties, seemed like half-remembered dreams.
"The captain was a fine man," Randall said.
Salop had awoken.
"He was."
Shatro and Shirla still slept. I pulled her close for warmth, and she moaned, but shut her eyes tighter.
"I wish there could be more like him on this world," Randall said.
"Lenk chose it so," Salop said, his tone neutral.
"The best divaricates. Few like the captain or like us."
"Numa forbid," Randall said, and he repeated this several times, voice fading, before he fell asleep.
"Olmi," Salop said, "are you curious about the storm beast?"
I did not know whether Olmi might be curious or not. I cared little myself.
"I see a diagram of its anatomy in my head," Salop said. "A loose anatomy. It came to me while I napped."
"Good," I croaked.
"A central void like the eye of a storm filled with bergs of ice. Air and ocean are brought together, mixed violently, churned to control the energies used to grow the scions within. The caudal portion must be a vast factory of nutrients,
nourished within the storm and harvested by the wall of knives. Scions, perhaps those no longer useful, worn out by the action of the inner storm, are sacrificed, transformed into the brown disks, which are whisked away to the upper reaches and spread out much later over the land, or wherever the storm has forged alliances with other ecoi. I am sure the storm is a separate ecos all to itself, master of its circle of the Darwin Sea. I thought vaguely that he had been talking a very long time. "We weren't tasty, I assume," he concluded, and fell silent. More meteors. That meant there were comets and other latent debris in the Lamarckian system, as well as the five planets spotted by the original surveyors. No asteroid belts. All swept away by gigantic Pacifica, visible to me now as a brilliant blue point, brightest of all the points in the sky. This level of thinking astounded me. I did not know where it came from. "Do you know much about Sir Randall?" Salop asked later, interrupting my survey of the stars, which I had done many times already, forgetting the patterns I saw each time. "No," I said. "I like him." It seemed a pleasant thing to say, if meaningless. "He speaks highly of you, but then he believes you're special. He believes you're recently arrived from Thistledown." This was interesting enough to arouse a few brain cells, and I tried hard to focus on what Salop was saying. "He heard this from Thomas the Disciplinary at Calcutta. Many people in positions of authority have been expecting an appearance such as this might be at any rate. Randall told me you're different, that you have a quiet about you not found here." He used a few code words. "Yes, I know them. I used to be one of the Adventists years ago, in my student days at Jakarta." "Adventists," I croaked. "Waiting for the Hexamon to open another gate. I imagine if a gate was opened, Lenk would know about it, since he has the remaining clavicle. Keeps it always close to him." "There was an old man in Moonrise," I said. "When I found him, he thought I was from Thistledown." I laughed, making an unpleasant half-croak, half-bark. "I wish I was," I said. "Somebody would come rescue me now. A gate would open right over us." I sketched the phenomenon against the stars with a trembling finger. "Randall took you on the ship and elevated you, he was so certain." "Oh." "Few know that we were Adventists. It doesn't lead to many promotions." Randall stirred, and Shirla began to push against my chest. Salop, a blurred shadow in the bright starlight, held his finger to his lips. "Dying people say things. Stupid things. Confidences."
"What's stupid?" Randall asked.
Neither of us answered. Shirla stretched, pushing her foot into the cold water. She jerked it back.
"No ships?"
she asked over the slap of the waves.
"No,"
I said. Shatro stopped snoring and sat up abruptly. Wide-eyed, he said,
"Did somebody try to push me off?"
"No,"
Shirla said.
"But I've been asleep."
"I belong here as much as any of you."
"No denying it,"
Shirla said softly, as if to soothe him.
"I'm still strong,"
Shatro said, shaking his head like a tired bull. Randall leaned over and touched his shoulder, patting him as if he were a child. Shatro gave him a sidelong look, eyes hooded, and hung his head between his knees. Dawn was a long time coming. Shirla and I held each other, and Salop talked now and then of the storm's design, and Shatro kept his silence. Randall sat upright on the planks, twitching his bare toes. Sometime in the dark, the water all around us whispered, and long blunt-headed necks or trunks rose from the sea. Curd-like clouds dappled what old cowboys would have called a buttermilk sky, swimming in star-thick black whey. The tall shapes glittered in the broken starlight, and they stood steady, patient, and I could not help but think they were interested in us. I lifted a hand and said,
"Take a bite. You'll know who I am."
But they slipped back into the water, and the whisper in the low waves stopped. With morning, a feverish clarity gripped me. 14. The sky to the east grew yellow, then copper, and spread its smooth sheet of faded blue westward. A few dying shreds of clouds lurked to the south, none overhead. The steady weather in the wake of the storm beast was becoming more changeable. I saw my companions, the planked remains of the Vigilant, the somewhat rougher waves around us, with the sharpness of a fine line drawing, each line vibrating faintly and seeming to zizz in my ears. I knew with absolute certainty that we were not going to die. There was a great drama playing itself out here, and we were in the center of it. The gate opener had placed me in an event of great interest, the humanizing of Lamarckia. Humans would populate the planet to exactly one half its capacity, and humanoids would fill the other half. The dividing line would be the equator. I chose the northern portion for the humans to avoid inconvenience. I seemed to hear Shimchisko telling me details. Time smudged itself, and some things happened before their proper place in the sequence of second to second, and some happened after. What came late was Salop's hoarse cry that he saw a ship. Of course he does, I thought. It's inevitable. If we're not going to die, there must be a ship.
One, two, three, he said. Four ships! Two steamships and two schooners, fore and aft rigged. Must be from Athenai. They like schooners there.
I looked with little interest in the direction of his finger. Two stripes of smoke rising high over the cold, stale sea, and in tow, perhaps, sails slack or furled, two sailing ships. They were quite close, perhaps a mile off. Salop stood. Shatro tugged on his ragged black pants, imploring him to sit down.
"If they have steamships, they're Bryanists," Shatro insisted, hunching his neck.
"There are only hope wherever they come from," Randall said, and stood awkwardly, making the raft sway to join Salop's arm-waving. Sherla watched them, mouth open to keep from pressing and splitting her dry lips. We were ghostly things, crusted white with salts, hair standing up thick from our heads.
"They won't see us," Shatro said miserably.
"They're turning," Randall said, and grinned down at us like a small boy who sees his father coming home.
"I believe they see us," Salop agreed.
"All inevitable." It took the ships half an hour to surround us and send out a lifeboat to pick us up. The steamships were 100 meters in length and about 25 meters across the beam, the largest ships I had seen on Lamarckia. Their broad, bulbous, white-painted hulls were made of thick planks, but long sweeps of metal formed much of the superstructure. Each ship carried 2 barreled guns, fore and aft, and a single smokestack put forth an opaque cloud. Within their hulls sounded the great thumps of powerful engines. The ships were blocky and ungraceful, but they looked sturdy. Men and women in gray and black uniforms stood by the rope railings and near the bows, watching and talking among themselves as a boat was lowered from one of 2 schooners. The schooners had dropped the tow lines. The wind was picking up, and crews were setting the broad sails on each of their 3 trees, getting ready to proceed once we were aboard. They were longer than the Vigilant, but not as thick across the beam, and they looked fast, like slender greyhounds beside the powerful, barrel-chested mastiffs of the steamships. Sherla kneeled on the planking as the boat approached, her arms crossed over her breasts. 5 occupied the boat, 4 rowers and a plump man in the prow, dressed in white and wearing a small black cap. The steamships displayed numbers on their white-painted bows, 34 and 15, but no names. The schooners were simply labeled Coragos and Cow. Cow seemed an odd name for so graceful a ship. The plump man in the bow of the boat waved to us, smiling cheerfully enough.
"What ship, and from what port?"
he asked as the boat came within 20 meters.
"From Vigilant out of Calcutta," Randall said. "What happened?"
"Sunk in a storm," Randall explained.
"How long ago?" the man asked, face showing great sympathy.
"A day, maybe 2."
"3-treed full rig?" the man asked.
"Yes," Randall said.
"We saw her. We saw the storm. A terrifying thing. We pulled out of its paws just after we lost sight of you."
"Your ships?" Randall asked, and the boat pulled up beside our raft.
"We did not see any schooners. We were way behind. The steamships look ugly, but they're fast, especially when the wind's asleep."
"Who are you?" Shatro asked.
"We're out of Athenai," the plump man said, looking uncomfortable. "Bound for Naderville. The steamships are escort."
"They came from positions off Jakarta, I understand."
"My name is Charles Ramkio."
He offered his hand and Randall shook it.
Then they helped us aboard.
Once on the boat, we saw how flimsy our raft had been. But it was the last we saw of any of the Vigilant. And as the rowers pulled us toward the Coragos, I felt sad at the sight. Shirla stayed close to me, accepting a cup of water poured from a jug, while a thin woman with a worried face asked about our health, what we had had to eat, and other questions. She was Julia Sand, a physician aboard the Coragos.
"They wouldn't have sunk us," Shatro murmured.
Salop seemed very solemn, unwilling to speak much. I wondered if he had guessed at something we were missing. Randall was ebullient. "You're a true gift of the winds," he told Keo, sipping from his cup as instructed, small swallows. We were near the larger of the two schooners when Salop leaned forward and whispered in my ear,
"Coragos. That means a leader of a chorus. She is Abel Lenk's boat."
He pulled back. Keo and Randall had caught part of his whisper, and the plump man looked even more uncomfortable.
"You'll have to come with us, of course," he said. "You know what's happening, I suppose."
"Is Lenk on board?" Randall asked.
"He is," Keo said.
"Going to Naderville?"
"To negotiate with Brian," Salop ventured.
Keo did not reply. We were brought aboard in slings and deposited on the deck of the big schooner. The other ships had already pulled away. They were now spread across nearly a mile of water, the two steamships leading the way. Lenk was going to parley. 15. The Coragos was a solemn ship. Of the 70 aboard, her crew was made up of 30 ABs, 5 apprentices, all children of Athenai citizens of rank, we were told, and 15 craft rates and officers. The remaining 20 were advisors, diplomats, and aides, and there was, of course, Lenk himself. The Cow carried a crew of 40 and 15 more diplomats. No restrictions were placed upon us, other than that we were not to bother Abel Lenk should we meet him on deck, which was unlikely. He spent most of his hours in the largest cabin, the captain's quarters in the forecastle, in the company of his advisors and diplomats, working day and night, Keo said. From this, Randall and Salop surmised the ships were indeed going to Naderville. Officers and selected guests of rank bunked in the stern. The crew bunked amidships. The berths on Coragos were all filled. We were provided with new clothes, and Randall, Shatro, Salop, and I were given places in a private cabin formerly occupied by 3 junior ABs. Where they went, we were not told. Shirla shared a berth with 2 female ABs. We were being treated with remarkable politeness, and I soon discovered why. Keo, assigned to make sure we were comfortable, informed us that the good Lenk was greatly upset at news of the loss of Captain Kaiser Bach and the Vigilant. "He believes the captain could have opened our eyes about Lamarckia," Keo said, standing in our cabin, handing out shirts and pants. Salop surveyed these fresh clothes with some displeasure. They were not black and not loose, but put them on without complaint. Abel Lenk looked forward to hearing about his discoveries in person. "We have lost all of our evidence," Salop said. "Still, I request an audience with the good Lenk on behalf of Captain Kaiser Bach."
"I'm sure he plans to meet with all of you," Keo said. "You will dine with the officers and crew this evening. Food will be brought to your cabins this afternoon, should you request it."
He smiled at us rosily, as if he were a steward welcoming us to a luxury cruise.
"I'm glad to hear you are little the worse for your ordeal."
Shatro fingered his red face delicately and winced.
"What's going to happen in Naderville?" he asked.
Keo shook his head.
"Not my place to say. Eventually, we'll return to Athenai."
Randall finished buttoning his shirt and stood, stooping to avoid the beams of the low ceiling. "I need to make a report on the loss of a ship to the captain and first officer," he said.
"Of course. I'll arrange for a formal hearing tomorrow."
"There's no blame. No reason for an inquest," Randall said softly. "The storm killed our ship. The captain did the best he could."
"I'm sure of it," Keo said, appearing as solemn as was possible for him. "We need to assess the losses for the shipping board in Athenai, of course.
Randall nodded gloomily.
Keo asked what else we required. Shatra wondered if any Lisbu sap was available.
For our burns, he said, poking at his arm and wincing again.
We were all red, our skins in sad shape from sun and exposure to the water.
I'm sure we have something similar, Keo said, and closed the door behind him.
It's all funk, Shatra said as we heard Keo's footsteps down the corridor outside.
Salop patted the thin mattress and blankets on the upper bunk, peered through the single porthole, lifted a ceramic washbasin.
Are you going to tell them about the skeletons? Shatra asked.
Yes, Salop said.
Shatra's face suddenly seemed to collapse and he covered it with his hands, not crying, but rubbing fiercely, as if to wipe away the burn and all that had happened in the past few days.
Everything we worked for. My training. Education.
We're lucky to be alive, Randall said.
I touched Shatra's arm, pained by what he was doing to himself.
Leave me alone, he growled, jerking away.
Please, I said. Don't rub your face like that.
What do you care?
He demanded, standing up from the lower bunk and bumping his head on the rail.
Enough, Salop said. Why are you so angry with this man?
Shatra stood in silence for a moment, hands limp by his sides.
We're all equal now, Randall said dryly. Let's make the best of it.
It will be a long time until we are back in Calcutta, Salop said.
Shatra went to the porthole and looked out at the ocean, his face peachy red in the glare.
I request to be relieved from my contract, he said. I may seek employment in Naderville.
He glanced around at us.
I'm sure they need researchers.
They probably do, Randall agreed, though I doubt that Good Link will appreciate it.
Shatra dismissed this with a wave.
He's going to Naderville to surrender, he said. Brian isn't coming to him.
Again, Shatra stated what seemed obvious to all. In the afternoon, after a lunch of real wheat bread and salted red briar cheese, a delicious specialty from Tasman Silva, I walked with Shirla around the ship, examining the Karago's graceful lines, admiring the craftsmanship of Lenk's personal ship. It was said that Lenk had turned down his advisors when they suggested such an appurtenance, and it had taken them years to convince him to change his mind. He needed to be able to travel in comfort with the people necessary to the growing government, of which he was still spiritual and political head. His presence on the ship gave the Karagos a special quality that Vigilant had lacked, a sense of grandeur. In design and rig, however, she was simply graceful and very well appointed. In truth, I devoted less attention to the ship's details than I did to Shirla. Between meetings with curious crew who exchanged greetings and asked about our health, we walked in silence, shoulder to shoulder. There was no longer a Sotario to catch us flarking, or a Rydiem to cluck at us in her motherly way, and no real sense of direction or duty. We had been relieved of that. Nearly being relieved of our lives had sparked something in me I could neither deny nor justify, an immediate need for confirmation. My life was too flimsy not to get on with basics, and Shirla satisfied one very real basic, female companionship. How far we were to go, I did not give much thought to. The direction seemed obvious. If and when the time was right, I would make love to her. As we walked, I examined Shirla with different eyes. She was not beautiful, not ugly. Face and arms red with exposure, skin shiny with ointment and beginning to flake. Hips ample, legs short but well-shaped, trunk long, neck long, head and face round, hair, of course, ragged, brown eyes small but intense and focused. She seemed ready at any moment to become satirical or critical, but she did not. In her motions and few words, she seemed very vulnerable, very open. On the bow, away from the general activity of the crew, we watched the broad blue ocean and cloudy, milky sky, the blurred ball of the sun.
"Do you ever think we should have died?"
she asked, eyes crinkled, lips drawn up in a half-grimace. "Why?" I asked.
"They were our shipmates. Our captain died."
"No reason for us to join them," I said, with perhaps too much briskness.
"I wonder."
"Don't," I said, irritated. "That nonsense just makes things worse. We're here because we survived, by chance and our best efforts. We can't be blamed for their deaths.
Will you ever be part of anything? She asked, glancing at me with quizzical eyes.
I could give no honest answer.
You have always been a terrible risk, Saromi, she said, looking away.
I tried to steer our talk in another direction. I've been incredibly lucky, actually, I said.
Why lucky? And why do you never...
I was lucky to find a berth on Vigilant. I was lucky to survive its sinking. And now I'm lucky to be sailing to Naderville with Abel Lenk. She could not guess how true this was. If I was to be at the center of things, I had been placed in remarkably apt situations many times. The gate opener had found his mark with supernatural skill. She puffed out her cheeks dubiously.
You don't make any sense, she said.
I'm lucky to be placed beside you. There, the maneuvering was fairly begun again.
You want to see my tits? She asked, totally serious.
Again I laughed, and this time her eyes narrowed in pain. You are remarkable, I said.
Do you know what I mean when I say that? She asked.
Not really.
The obvious. I'm joking, and this time I'm not joking, all right?
She had me baffled.
Sir Olmi, whoever you are, whatever you really want, I think I know one thing about you. One thing certain, right now. We almost died. That makes us horny. Your body wants me. You want to take me someplace private, but we'll do our little social dance on the deck first. Your mind thinks you'll make a small commitment and that'll be enough, and that I'm weak enough and my body wants you enough to make it happen.
While she said this, a little smile formed.
And you're not wrong.
Your body wants me? She nodded.
When the time is right. It isn't right now, of course, because we're very tired and I'm sad. But I'll get over that. And when I do, you'd better say yes and make your move the next time I ask, or you'll never get a chance again.
In all my experience with women, I had never encountered such an analytical and verbal approach. In the company of lovers on Thistledown, the graces of centuries of spaceborne civilization, of the highest of technologies and the closest of associations, the most sophisticated of cultural educations, had finally produced so many easeful ways for partners to join in the physical act of love that, it now seemed to me, much of the interest in such proceedings had been drained away. I had some small clue for the first time why I had broken my proposed bond in Alexandria. I stared out over the rail.
I put you at a loss, Sherla observed.
Not for the first time, I said.
My tits, she said, are not my finest feature.
What is your finest feature? I asked.
My heart, she said. It is a strong heart. It could beat with yours.
The warmth spread from my cheeks through the center of my chest to my groin. I was in the presence of natural genius. As castaways, we were treated with a delicate deference, as if we were ghosts or small gods of ill omen. Castaways rarely survived on Lamarckia. Humans were few and far between on this world. Losing a ship was tantamount to losing your life. Still, the officers and politicians treated us politely enough, and around our first dinner in the ranks mess, Randall told our story to the assembled officers and craft rates. The captain, Lenk himself, and most of his aides were not present, but Lenk had sent his second, a slender woman of middle years named Ulrika Facid, who listened to Randall's telling with solemn fascination. He did not mention the humanoid skeletons by prior agreement with Salib, who thought that news should be reserved for Lenk's ears only. I suspect they still thought they could get another expedition out of the news once these troubles blew over. After the story, the first officer, a tall, well-built woman named Helmina Leschewitz, called for a toast to survivors, one and all. Three stewards cleared the tables efficiently, and sharp Tasmanian wine was served in crystal goblets. I had still not developed a taste for Lamarckian alcoholic beverages, but Salop, Randall, and Shatro savored theirs with an intensity that brought smiles from the assembled men and women. Sherla accepted her glass but barely touched it. The lights over the long table swayed in the gentle sea. Around the walls, ABs and some apprentices had crowded in to listen to the proceedings.
"Your story is grim," Facid said as we worked in traditional fashion toward another toast.
Your survival is surely a gift of fate. Your courage is an example to us all.
Lifted glasses around the table.
Beyond the loss of good humans, the greatest loss is wit and knowledge, she continued. Lenk himself funded Captain Kaiser Bach in his endeavors.
I studied Fassid, but she was too practiced to reveal much about herself. As with the best politicians I have known, she seemed at once present and real, yet gave out little useful information. She had learned her trade in rough times at the knees of a master. As we left the officer's mess, she approached Salop and whispered something in his ear, then hurried off. Salop approached Randall, who stood by Sherla and myself in a corner. Shatro stood in the shadow of a doorway. When we were on the deck and alone, a firm, cool breeze blowing on us all, Salop said,
"Abel Lenk requests our presence later this evening, about midnight."
Sherla sighed. We were all still very tired. Salop continued,
"He wishes our advice. There is disturbing news from Shia, from Naderville. Lenk only brought one expert researcher with him, thinking this would be purely a political journey. We may be of use."
"Shall we tell them tonight about what we've seen?" Randall asked. Salop frowned and cocked his head to one side.
"I do not know. None of this feels right."
We had 4 hours between the end of dinner and our scheduled appointment with Lenk. The deck was lightly crewed at night in such fine weather. Sherla and I walked the deck again, saying little, but keeping our eyes open for privacy. At the bow, behind an equipment locker, a bale of matte fiber lay in shadow. The moons were down, and we sat in starlight only. And after 5 minutes talking undisturbed, we undressed each other to the extent that caution and need demanded. She accepted me with a tense and earnest eagerness that I found very exciting. I had seldom made love with such simplicity and speed. Fashions and centuries of development on Thistledown had given sex a rich clutter of nuance as formal as a ceremonial feast. Sherla knew none of this. As she had said, her body wanted me, and that was more than enough. When we finished, her face was slick with both sweat and tears and gleamed in the starlight. We caught our breaths, then fumbled to clothe ourselves in the dark.
"You haven't done this in a long time," she said.
"How do you know?"
"Have you?"
"No," I answered.
"I didn't show you everything," she said.
"What, your tits?" I asked. But my face was in shadow, and she could not see my smile.
"No, idiot," she said gently. "In my village, when a woman chooses a man..."
"Not the other way around?" She put her finger on my lips.
"When that happens, we make a fine picnic, and take it in a basket into the Silva, find an open place, maybe beneath a cathedral tree, spread a blanket. I ask about your family, and you ask about mine. We talk about mutual friends, what our plans are.
The rule is that we have children soon. We talk about that." I've met a woman here who resented being made into a brood mother. After saying this, I realized the phrasing might seem odd. I was speaking like a newcomer. Sherla mulled in silence before asking,
"Who was that?"
"The master's bondmother, in Calcutta." We sat up on the makeshift mattress. Sherla idly poked fiber back into the bale.
"Some women feel that way. Maybe more than just a few."
"And you?" She lifted her eyes. They glittered faintly in the dark.
"I think Lamarckia will be the next Earth," she said. "I don't know why, but I see us prospering here. And I still do, despite what Salop found."
"So you won't mind having many children?"
"I've never had any," she said. "Would you mind?"
I had never given the least thought to having children. On Thistledown, reproduction was, if anything, more ritualized and nuanced than sex. Most Geshel couples chose ex-utero births. Many Naderites did as well. It was cleaner and certainly less painful. But none of that had ever seemed real to me. I was much too young to be a father. The one artificial capability not removed from my body was conscious choice of whether or not to be fertile.
"I asked you first," I said. My throat caught and I coughed. "Makes you nervous?"
"I suppose it does. It certainly should."
"Me too. I've always been a little odd. I don't know whether the world needs children like me."
"Everyone feels that way," I said.
though I could hardly know that.
Not my sisters. They're already lost in thickets of kids. At any rate,
she held my shoulders and squeezed lightly.
I do not do this to obligate you.
I said nothing. I could not tell her how unobligated I was forced to be.
But I've never protected myself either. I follow Lenk's dictates. I'm a little in awe that he's on the same ship with us.
I had a sudden image of Lenk personally encouraging Shirla to propagate.
He'll be such a somber man now, she said, and old. All this must wear him down.
What, meeting us out here?
She pinched my nose. I've always had bad taste in men.
Salop, Randall, Shatro, Shirla, and I walked forward along the corridor to Lenk's quarters. Keo met us midships. The craftsmanship on the Coragos was particularly beautiful as we approached the forecastle. The walls gleamed black and gray and brown, using the inlaid cores of some Tasman arborite I could not identify. Electric lights gleamed steadily every 2 meters, shining down on elegant carpet woven in earthly floral patterns. Our muffled footfalls alerted a male guard who came to stiff attention, a short, broad rifle cradled in his thick brown arms.
This is the first time in our history on Lamarckia that Abel Lenk has felt it necessary to keep armed security around him, Keo explained, nodding at the guard who glanced at us with flat, emotionless eyes.
It was warm in the corridor, and his face beaded with sweat. Keo knocked on the door twice. It was opened by a thin, graceful young man dressed in a formal gray suit. He swung his arm wide with a cautious smile.
Abel Lenk is just finishing a nap. He'll be with us in a few minutes. My name is Ferrier, Samuel Inman Ferrier.
We shook hands formally. A mechanical clock mounted on the bulkhead over the door chimed midnight. Salop sat on a couch. Shatro sat beside him, eyes darting nervously, as if he were a little boy about to see a doctor. Shirla, Randall, and I sat in individual chairs spaced around the cabin, which stretched across the bow of the ship. The cabin beyond, Lenk's sleeping cabin, was much smaller. I thought it odd that he would choose the bow. Apprentices much preferred to stay out of the bow, especially in heavy seas. Perhaps he had a perverse sense of asceticism. Shelves on the bulkhead opposite my seat contained a few dozen books, none of them ornately bound and all of them well used. They seemed to include statute books and city record summaries. I wondered where the clavicle was kept. Would Lenk take it with him on a journey as uncertain as this? Ferrier served us matte fiber tea on a black Lisbu tray. As we drank, I heard faint shuffles behind the door of the sleeping cabin. The door opened, and Jamie Cart Lenk entered. I had seen pictures of him from 45 years before. Then he had been a vigorous man of natural middle age, handsome and conservatively dressed, with a presence even in the records that radiated assurance and power. Now Lenk was still tall, unbent by his years, his hair still mostly dark, his face deeply wrinkled but in all the right places. Laugh lines at corners of lips and eyes, lines of sternness near the laugh lines, and a brow that seemed monumentally smooth and untroubled. A tall, unfurrowed brow whose owner had slept cleanly and in assurance of the truth for many decades. He wore a simple long green robe. His sandaled feet, peeking from beneath the hem of the robe, were broad and splay-toed. He slowly turned to face us and shake hands all around. "Thank you for being patient," he said, staring at us one by one as if we were old friends. "Ferrier, I'll take a cup of that tea." He sat in a large black high-backed chair bolted in the corner beneath the books, and when he was settled he looked up in sadness and said, "I deeply regret the loss of Captain Kaiserbach and his researchers. The loss of a ship full of men and women is one thing, evil enough and hard to bear, but the death of such a man." He shook his head and accepted the cup of steaming tea, then set it on a side table, ignoring it. "I am gratified, of course, that you survived. Sirs Keo and Facid have told me some of your story. About the storm, how our escort of Bryon's ships may have frightened you into its winds." He swallowed, his Adam's apple bobbing in his wrinkled, corded throat. His sadness was genuine. Despite his clear brow, he had obviously experienced a lot of sadness recently.
"You could not have known, Sir Lenk," Salop said. "It is remarkable fortune to be rescued by you. These seas are so rarely traveled. If any ships would have picked you up, that they would be part of this absurd entourage only adds a peck to the improbability. And that is the main part of our problem, no? I go to Shia, to Naderville, precisely because we have had so little traffic with the people who live there." He examined us closely, his jaw working. He lifted the cup and sipped from it. The warm liquid seemed to invigorate him. "You are Sir Salop," he turned his head to Randall. "And you are Sir Randall. Both of you sailed often with Captain Kaiser Bach. When he made his request, he spoke of you as necessary members of the expedition." Randall inclined his head, then looked up at Lenk with calm, large eyes. "We've made important discoveries, Sir Lenk," Salop said. Lenk followed his own line of thought. "I'll read your reports when they're written. Now there's so little time. I have been in need of more researchers. Questions of considerable importance have arisen. Difficulties of some magnitude." Salop, rebuffed so smoothly, stared a little pop-eyed at Lenk, but even he lacked the gall to interrupt Jamie Cart Lenk. "The Naderville researchers claim to have made great strides with the ECOS on Shia. The researcher on my ship does not credit these reports. I don't know what to think." "What sort of strides?" Salop asked. Lenk looked over our heads and lifted his cup. He smiled as if at some great joke, too large to deserve laughter. "Queens and hidden masters, palaces in the clouds, Cibola, Atlantis, the afterlife. I do not know which Brian means, but I see his ships, and I know the power that he shows us, that he's amassed in the past 2 years and has used against us." He made a little shrug and lowered the cup. "He is not mad, whatever his generals do." "Blockades, sieges, piracy," Randall said. Lenk leaned his head to one side, scratching at the lobe of one ear. "General Bayes accompanies us," he said. "He raided 19 villages before we left Calcutta," Randall continued, his face colored with anger. "Stole tools and metal stores, took children, killed some or all of the citizens." "It pains me to think of the children and citizens," Lenk said softly. "I hate to bargain under those circumstances, but there was no choice."
"Brian denies it all, of course,"
Ulrika Fassid said, entering the cabin on soft, slippered feet. She closed the door behind her, nodded casually to Lenk, gave Randall a stern, half-puzzled look, and apologized for being late.
"I've just come back from Number 15.
Bayes and Captain Yolenga say they've received their final instructions. May I speak before our guests?" Lenk gave permission with a lift of his hand. "We are to sail to the main port and up a canal to an inland lake. Our charts indicate this canal has been modified by the ECOS, and that the lake is isolated from Naderville proper. It may be the site of these alleged researches. Sir Keo, have you told our guests what to expect?"
"As much as we know," Keo said. "A magnificent lack of detail."
"Good. We'll have little time to talk once we arrive, and not much more on the way there. But you must keep your eyes open and digest what you see. It may be crucial to our negotiations."
"We need to know if it's a bluff," Keo said.
Then his face flushed as if he had spoken out of turn. "No bluff," Lenk said, shaking his head.
"Not everyone agrees with you, Jamie," Ulrika said.
"I personally regard Brian as a compelling liar."
"He is a force of nature," Lenk said. "I unleashed his kind when I brought us all here."
"We shouldn't confuse Brian with the Adventists."
Her glance at Salop seemed particularly significant.
"Brian has no honor. He's interested in power and position. He uses Bayes as his iron fist and hopes to isolate himself from the moral consequences."
Fassett stood beside Lenk and examined him solicitously, touching his wrist like a doctor.
"You're tired, Jamie," she said. "Time for a good night's sleep."
He stared at us with a wry smile. "I do not sleep the night through. That leaves me with far too much time to think. But, Ulrika, Sir Salop seems to have something he wants to tell us. Can it wait? Ulrika asked Salop, eyes flashing a challenge.
I would prefer to speak now, Salop said calmly.
So important?
We believe so.
What is it? Lenk asked, leaning forward, elbows on knees, clasping his hands.
I glanced at Shirla and Shatro. Shatro seemed lost in his own thoughts, staring at the richly woven carpet on the floor. I wondered about his quiet concentration.
Shirla appeared out of her depth, frightened by the social altitude, yet fully alert.
Salop told them what we had found on Martha's Island, concluding with the loss of all our specimens in the storm.
Ulrika's lips pressed together until they formed a grim straight line. Lenk's shoulders hunched around his neck.
Dear God, Lenk said.
He gave no sign of either believing or disbelieving.
That doesn't make sense, Facit said, though without conviction.
Keo and Ferrier stood in silence, as if absorbing news of the death of a loved one.
It is true, whatever we wish to believe, Salop said.
Some misinterpretation.
Remains of humans, not scions, Facit murmured. You said three vanished from the Jittermeier expedition, and her husband's body was exhumed and carried off by scions.
Salop shook his head, and Randall finally spoke.
The captain and I saw them. They were not the remains of humans, and they were real.
Are real.
There may still be specimens on Martha's Island.
We all saw them, Shatro spoke up, still staring at the carpet.
Another expedition, Facit huffed. The captain pressed us hard for years. Now, after hearing this, we're to start all over again. This sounds much like Brian's idiocy.
Salop let this pass without reacting. Randall edged forward on his seat, but Salop touched his arm and he remained silent.
We'll be in Naderville in 2 days, Lenk said softly.
He stood, and Ferrier and Facit each took an arm, helping him toward the door to his sleeping quarters. Ferrier opened the door, and Lenk turned to Salop before passing through.
Was I mistaken to bring us here? Are we to be rejected like a plague by the entire world?
No one spoke. Facit saw him through the door, and Ferrier accompanied him. Then she turned to us, and her eyes drilled into Salop.
How dare you, she spat. How dare you bring us such nonsense for your own political gain?
Salop's eyes became hooded and dangerous as he gripped the arms of his chair until his knuckles whitened.
This wonderful man has the weight of the entire planet on his shoulders, and you bring him ghost stories, all to maintain your beloved scientific stature.
Randall sat up, his voice harsh in the small cabin.
Sir Facit, you're very mistaken.
Facit pushed her hands out in disgust and turned away. Keo seemed in an agony, caught between supporting Facit and remaining a genial host. Randall squared off with her in the middle of the cabin.
I have had enough of ships and the sea for a lifetime. I will gladly retire to Jakarta or Calcutta or Naderville if it comes to that. But that will not stop the truth of what we saw. You opposed all our research out of ignorance and devotion to some faded philosophy that has served none of us well, Randall continued, his words sharpening to hisses or dropping to growls. Captain Kaiser Bach debated you over and over, hoping to find some shred of sense. You have poorly advised good Lenk, Sir Facit, and if you continue to play the fool, I will bring you low.
The grim pronouncement carried an element of comic opera, but it was heartfelt. Facit's eyes seemed lost in shadow.
There's no time for this, she said smoothly. Whatever happens in the next few days may bring us all low. Compared to General Bay's, your threats are small rain.
She walked around Keo and left through the port side door. Randall took a deep breath and looked at Keo as if he had a little more anger to vent should anyone want to challenge him. Keo raised his hands.
I think we should all rest, he said. It's been very tense.
I'm sure it has, Salop said, taking Randall's elbow.
Randall took a deep breath, stared around the room, and lowered his head.
Let's go.
We retired to our own cabins.
Randall joined Shirley and me on the deck the next morning to survey the ships and the surrounding waters. The weather was calm, the ocean smooth.
Salop's asked for notebooks. He's preparing a full report for Lenk, Randall said. He shook his head sadly. I should have kept my mouth shut. I've just made us a stronger enemy.
16.
Shia became a dark line on the horizon early in the morning, half obscured by thick patches of cloud heavy with rain. As the four ships drew closer to land, we were hit by several squalls, and with their passing, Coragos and Cao took advantage of a fresh, vigorous wind, set their sails, and cast loose of the steamships. 10 miles out, all four ships were met by three fast sloops. One carried two pilots for our schooners, and they boarded to guide us into the harbor. Our pilot took his post by the wheel and gave quick, precise orders. I knew their type, young, earnest, nervous, terribly afraid of making a mistake. They had been raised under harsh conditions, I guessed, in a society pushed to the very edge. Shirla stayed by my side.
I don't like it, she said. The steamships, the crews, the pilots, they all look stiff.
The clouds blew south. Lenk's ships put on a glorious show, sails brilliant white in the morning sun, and even pulled ahead of the steamships for a time, until the pilots ordered us to furl our sails. Us. Our. I had taken sides in this dispute. Perhaps from the moment I arrived and saw the slaughter at moonrise, I could not be objective. The more I saw, the firmer my commitment became. Yet I could not simply dump all my objectivity. I owed nothing to anyone but the Hexamon, and all of these people were equally in violation. The coast of Shia was painted by bright sun. From the sea, the shore had appeared deep brown, spotted with red and dark purple. Now, from less than 2 miles, Shia's zone showed itself as a forbidding hedgerow tangle 50 or 60 meters high, dark and uniform, its upper surface covered with leathery growths that screened all sun from the ground below. The dark thicket stretched back to far mountains topped by white clouds. Baker had believed that Shia was older than most other Ikoi, and had developed early in the biosphere's history before oxygen had reached current levels. The leathery covering on the hedgerow silva might have protected against ultraviolet light, which penetrated the atmosphere easily before the buildup of an ozone layer. I thought of the immigrants surveying Lamarckia from the hastily opened gate, trying to pick the best place to settle, choosing Elizabeth's land because it most resembled an earth landscape, even though the colors were wrong. Salap came on deck, notebook under his arm, and looked at the coastline, black hair tossed by the wind. He squinted and pointed a long finger. "It is like this everywhere on the continent," he said. "Dreary. A terrible place to settle. Hoagland's followers had to hack their way in, do without sun for months at a time, live like beasts in a cave. Still, for all that, they founded a city." Naderville was smaller than Calcutta. Even now, according to the best guesses, it contained less than 4,000 citizens. I had to adjust my sense of scale to regard such a limited population as a military force to be reckoned with. Shirla and I sat near the bow, a little awkward that there was no work for us to do. The habit of the sea had gotten into her more than into me, and the nervousness of being on a ship and not working made her open up as she never had before. She told me about her family in Jakarta, actually in a little village called Resorna at the tip of a spit of land 5 miles south of Jakarta. The past did not come out of her easily, and she frequently had to pause, eyebrows drawn in concentration, not because her memory was faulty, but because she had expended so much effort to forget the hard times. During the fluxing, when she was a young girl, her family had taken her from Calcutta and traveled with a dozen other families to Jakarta in Petain's zone, where edible phytids grew in more abundance, and where some land had sufficient natural minerals and was easily cleared for farming. The winters in Jakarta were always mild, but there had still been hardship. Petain's zone had prepared itself for some onslaught by the newly united zones, and most of its scions, arborids, phytids, and mobile types alike, had coated themselves with waxy armor and gone dormant for 3 months. "We had enough food from our own crops by then," Shirla said, "but I was scared. My brothers and I kept a pet scion, a dipper, and I found it sealed up on the porch in front of our house one morning. The next day it was gone. It had broken its rope somehow.
It had never done that before. Then Petain returned to normal. I guess it decided Elizabeth wasn't going to attack. She told about her family, uncles and aunts, first father and first mother, her biological parents, and her second father and second mother, who had no children of their own and treated her and her brothers with doting kindness. She remembered no third set of parents. That made sense. Triad families designed by a society where children seldom numbered more than two to a set of parents became unwieldy when there were six or seven children to each mother and father. She was lucky, she said, to have had a second set, though she felt sorry for them, not having biological children. She talked about several women in her village coming down with an odd malfunction, not exactly a disease, some sort of immune challenge that caused their ovaries to become inflamed. Several had had to have their ovaries removed. "The rest were fortunate," she said. "They kept their ovaries." That seemed to her more important in a way than their survival. Something had changed in the Divaricates on their arrival in Lamarckia. Lank had encouraged new births, of course, but Divaricates had generally had no more children on Thistledown than other Naderites, no more even than most Geshels. On Lamarckia, having children had become a ruling passion, as if some hidden drive had been awakened, and the human race, isolated as this weak little seed on a huge world, had needed to spread its limbs and foliage far and wide once more. The ships were guided into Naderville's harbor in the early afternoon. The city perched on a headland on the northern side of the harbor, its back to a wall of thoroughly tunneled hedgerow thicket. To the south was a natural spit of rock and sand that served as a breakwater. Naderville looked remarkably like Calcutta, golden and beige and white buildings rising on low hills facing the harbor. On the eastern extension of the headland, however, in the crater of a small extinct volcano, a military encampment had been established some 5 years before. The Caragos's physician, Julius Sand, had been to Naderville some years before as part of an abortive diplomatic effort and explained these features to Sherla and me. Farther inland, the harbor connected with a wide canal, which may have once been a natural river, but had been adapted by the Ecos to its own needs. Sturdy little tugs took us in tow, then pulled us to the western extent of the harbor and the mouth of the great Sheehan Canal. I watched the steamships as we drew apart, wondering if I might ever meet General Bayes in person. A sharp, buttery scent mixed with something herbaceous like oregano and an undercurrent of tar blew with the wind from inland. It was not unpleasant, but I thought in time such a smell might grow irritating. We cruised with great dignity behind the tugs for several miles, then were taken north through a narrow brickwork gate into a small lake. Hills rose on all sides, covered with dark, ancient thicket. On the higher hills, a few small white and sky-blue buildings seemed to clamber up the thickets and perch on top. I could make out holes hacked through the thickets like tunnels where roads might pass. On a bluff at the northern end of the harbor, the thicket had been cleared completely, leaving chalky, barren soil and buildings, a watchtower and storage sheds. Julia Sand had not seen this part of Naderville in her last visit.
"It's all new to me," she said.
On one side of the lake, ramps and large dry docks stood, a shipbuilding and repair site now idle. Randall and Salop came forward to join us. Shatro was still below decks. He seemed to be depressed, and we had not seen much of him for a day. "It's a dreary land," Randall commented. Salop scanned the small lake and announced, "Three ships. I was expecting many more." The three ships in the lake were not even steamships. Two were sloops, and one was a catamaran, with tattered fore and aft rigged sails hanging on two masts. It was not much of a navy.
"They're all out raiding or keeping a blockade on Jakarta," Sherla said.
"Perhaps," Salop said, but he seemed dubious. The pilots guided us past the empty dry docks, toward a small pier at the northern end of the lake. I estimated there was room for perhaps five or six ships the size of the steamships, no more. That would be a substantial navy on Lamarckia, but there was no way of telling how many steamships had been built. I looked for fuel bunkers, whatever the fuel might be, but could not find any. A few dozen men and women stood on the docks watching us, but the pier was empty. No formal reception committee awaited Link's arrival.
The tugs let us loose. The light breeze was sufficient for our schooners to moor at the pier. Ferrier and Keogh came up on deck dressed in dark gray pants and long black coats, formal wear for a solemn occasion. They surveyed the pier with wounded expressions like dogs who half expected to be struck. Both shook their heads at the indignity.
"This is no way to treat the good link," Keogh said. "I wonder why we came at all, if they're going to rub our noses in it."
"It's weakness," Ferrier said with an edge of anger he had not revealed before. Keogh took his arm and they assumed their positions by the gangway. Link came up from below on the stairs, aided by Facid, who blinked at the bright sunshine. Link wore sunglasses. He seemed for a moment to have gone blind, stumbling slightly, smiling, reaching for Facid. But he removed his sunglasses after a moment and stared at us owlishly, then studied the dry docks south of us, the western shore of the lake, the pier. Five men and three women stepped out of a gray shed and waited for our ships to maneuver close. Three young men near the bow tossed lines to them, and our ship was pulled in and tied up. All sails were furled. We waited several minutes. The lake was still and quiet. The Silva had not made a sound since our arrival. A single road stretched from the harbor through the hills to a tunnel in the high thicket beyond. It did not look promising.
"Are they expecting us to walk?" Ferrier asked in disgust.
"Intolerable," Facit said. But Lenk raised his hand.
"He's feeling his power," Lenk said. He pressed his teeth together and drew his shoulders up.
I thought I saw a brief spark of anger, but it might have been some internal twinge, a sore joint or other infirmity of age.
Let him have that much.
A reception committee of sorts was just now coming down the road. An electric truck passed through the main gate to the harbor and pier, followed by four small electric cars and a wavering line of men and women on bicycles. Shirla whistled at all the vehicles.
"There aren't that many in all of Calcutta," she said, "except for tractors."
What had seemed at first glance, then, to be a paltry show of ceremony was sufficient to impress the people around me. The gangway was pushed across to the dock and secured. The dock hands arranged along Caragas's moorage craned their necks curiously, looking for Lenk. Whatever Brian's social changes and political pressures, the citizens of Naderville still expressed an interest in the good Lenk who had brought them here. The truck and cars and bicycles rolled out onto the pier. The truck whined to a stop. The cars parked behind, and the bicyclists, all dressed in gray and brown, braked to a halt around and between them. Everybody paused for several seconds, waiting. And then the doors of the truck opened, and a man and a woman got out. The car's drivers opened their doors and got out as well. They all wore black, with little round hats pulled tight on their heads like swimming caps. The man and woman from the truck were dressed in white formal suits. They resembled socialites at an early first-century Thistledown full-dress occasion. Producing a walking stick, the man stood beside the woman, and they advanced together toward the gangway where they paused. Clearly, they expected our party to disembark now. Up to this point, however, not a word was said on either side. The only voices were those of the crew arranging the sails and rigging, and even they spoke in hushed tones. Ferrier and Keogh crossed the gangway first and bowed to the man and woman in white, who returned their greetings with slightly reduced bows. Ulrika Facit came next, advancing her hands along the rope guards in nervous arcs, gripping the ropes carefully, as if someone might tip the platform and make her fall into the water between the dock and the ship. After them came Link, marching across to the dock by himself with a good show of assurance and vigor. Five men and four women followed, all wearing green and tan, the colors of Link's personal guard. Last of all, three men we had not met, elderly enough to have served Link since the immigration, joined the party on the dock, giving and receiving brief bows. We were not going ashore, apparently. Salop smiled his most philosophical smile and turned back to go below. Randall watched the crew reclaim the gangway and close the gate and the bulwark.
"I'll be damned," he said.
Shirla sighed, as much with relief as disappointment.
"I don't like being at the center of things," she said.
Randall said, "I feel about as necessary as a man's nipples."
A few minutes later, a train of 4 gray electric buses hummed through the gate to the docks and parked by the Coragos and Cow. 12 grim-looking men in gray and black stepped down from the buses and spoke to their colleagues on guard by the gangways. Guards came aboard the ships and informed the masters and mates that all but a skeleton crew of 4 would have to get on the buses. The ships were going to be impounded, it seemed. Randall watched these activities with a heavy frown. "That's not diplomacy," he muttered. "It's an act of war." We sat, crowded, 3 to a seat, 2 seats across and 7 deep, on rough, unpadded benches made of pithy thicket xyla. The buses were driven by older men in white and gray. Seeing the preponderance and variety of uniforms, I felt a shiver of recognition. A regimented society, each job given its rank and place and dress. Ancient grand schemes reenacted on Lamarckia. The buses took us into the tunnels through the thickets, and we were surrounded by intense gloom. Sherla huddled close to me, Shatro beside her. In the gleam of headlights reflected toward the back, I saw Shatro staring grimly ahead, sweating, though it was cool. He had said very little the past few hours, and did not look at anyone for very long. Randall sat on the bench ahead of us, and Salah 2 benches behind. We did not talk. We all felt as though we were going to an execution, perhaps our own. The tunnels formed a kind of road network through the thicket, and the drivers seemed to know the routes well. After 20 minutes, we saw daylight ahead, and the buses emerged into a broad natural clearing. Behind, the thicket rose up in a gentle curve like the rim of a bowl, and we seemed to be in a broad crater painted with red and brown foliage. Ahead, across a level plain covered with a carpet of mottled orange and brown phytids, the interior of this part of Shiazikos was hauntingly terrestrial. We might have been crossing a tropical grassland, but instead of trees, tangles of thicket woven from meter-thick vines rose like watchtowers, capped with spreading branches whose tips lanced skyward. Farther inland, after another 10 minutes of travel, we saw great purple hemispheric mounds like mold growths, but each perhaps 2 kilometers wide and 1 kilometer high. At the top of the mounds, a single monumental black spike rose, a thorn to prick the thumb of a god. The guards on the bus took this all in without excitement. This was their landscape, familiar for decades. Salap seemed as little interested. Sherla, however, leaned forward and looked past my chest through the window. "They're taking us to a grand hotel," said the man behind us, dressed in a white uniform, one of Coragus's stewards. "They'll feed us like kings." "Tom's the joker," grumbled a woman across the aisle. The bus lurched, and we turned onto a dusty, bare dirt road. Ahead, another wall of thicket loomed. But this was brilliant green. The first green I had seen in a Lamarckian silva, topped with red lances. Above this thicket flew bat-like pterids with wingspans of at least 1 meter. As we approached, the pterids all dropped and grabbed hold of the red lances, like flies alighting on the bloody points of swords. The buses swung into another dark tunnel, following closely through the darkness, lights blooming and fleeing on the backs of our heads. "Inner compound," the bus driver called over his shoulder, voice husky. "We'll all get out here and walk into the citadel." "Citadel," Sherla repeated, eyebrows raised. The buses drew up in single file beside a road paved with broad, flat black stones, white cement between. We left the buses and stood in groups on the edge of the road, the sun brilliant and hot overhead, the sky tinted orange. Shading my eyes, I saw the sky was filled with tiny flying things, orange, yellow, and brown, each no more than 1 centimeter square, flocking in thick clouds about 20 meters over our heads. At the end of the road, a blocky stone wall rose high enough for its top to be blurred and half obscured by the yellow and orange clouds. The wall reached across a gap between 2 stretches of green thicket. The guards took us from the buses with a minimum of cordiality, lined us up in 2 rows and urged us forward toward the stone wall. Sherla stayed resolutely beside me, Shatro, Randall, and Salap ahead.
"Excuse me, is this where Abel Lenk is staying?" a sailor from the cow asked the bulky, thick-faced guard.
The guard shook his head, raised his lips in what might have been a smile but more resembled a grimace of discomfiture, and pointed to the wall. I studied the faces of the guards without catching their attention. Flat expressions and muscle predominated. Hair cut short but for a lock on the left side which trailed to the shoulder. Uniforms neatly pressed, but judging from their movements, only fair military order. Some managed to talk or smile briefly to the two lines as we were marched, but their character and behavior did not reassure me. I felt as if I were back in the slaughtered village of Moonrise, and my neck hair bristled as it had not even during our time in the Storm Beast. The longer I stayed on Lamarckia, the more I felt sure I was going to die here, in an ancient and degrading fashion. I longed for Thistledown and could not imagine why I could ever have accepted such an assignment. "I wish the storm had eaten us," Sherla muttered. I touched her elbow with my hand, a brushing gesture that still caught the attention of the thick-faced guard. He gazed at me out of the corners of his eyes, pulled his lips together, and shook his head slightly. At the gate in the wall, a small deep-sunk pair of doors barely wide enough for two to enter abreast, the lines were halted, and the guards milled about, making last-minute checks for anything we might be carrying. They poked and prodded us like animals, conferred, and then the senior officer, a tall, stoop-shouldered fellow whose uniform sleeves rode up on his arms, called out, and the doors swung wide. We entered the wall. 17. Dark stone. Cool shadow for several meters. Then an intense milky green light that seemed to hang like a canopy of fog. The air smelled sweet and slightly bitter. "Don't be alarmed," the stoop-shouldered senior officer called out as the lines marched into the greenness. "It's no worse than taking a shower. We've all done it. Your Abel Link has done it and said it was a pleasure." Small scions, no larger than midges, filled the air in a swirling mist and lighted on our skin and crawled beneath our clothes until we each wore a pale green coat. Sherla squirmed and tried to brush them off, but they clung tenaciously, like living green oil. "Do not be alarmed," the guards repeated, and the thick-faced fellow reached a xyla stick past me and poked her in the back, bobbing his head at her. I restrained a strong urge to grab the stick and shove it back. "These are servants, not pests. They clean you up for your visit with Sir Bryon." After a few minutes of mild discomfort, more at the thought than the actual sensation, the tiny creatures rose into the air again and hovered above our heads, filling the upper reaches of a large white-walled cell open at the top to the sky. I turned to look at Randall and Salop. Salop lifted his arms, the last of the tiny scions rising from him like green steam. He seemed stunned, his face slack, more surprised than he had been upon seeing the humanoid skeletons. Never in the history of the immigrants on Lamarckia had scions ever served humans or strongly interacted with them in any way. Randall stood stiff as a board, eyes half closed, and shook his shoulders to make sure he was free of the creatures. The guards moved us through the door at the opposite end of the white cubicle, and we came to a broad courtyard surrounded by densely packed, flat-fronted gray brick buildings. The courtyard, except for us, was empty, and it quickly became obvious that we were not in Naderville proper, but in some special compound, the most likely conclusion being that this was a kind of prison. Sherla took hold of my arm despite the poking stick of a guard. When the guard poked at her hard, making her flinch, I could not stand still any longer. I turned and grabbed the stick, wrenched it from his grip, and broke it in two. The thick-faced fellow stared at me in dumb surprise. Around us, the other guards began to break us into groups of four or five. Still, I met the thick-faced man's stare for several seconds, until he pointed to the broken stick on the ground and said, "Pick it up." Sherla stooped to do so, but I brought her back to her feet with a not very gentle jerk. She looked between us with eyes squinted, but took hold of my arm again. "Pick it up," the guard repeated, his face reddening. He advanced a half step. None of the guards had guns. All my senses sharpened, and I examined the situation almost dispassionately,
seeing how many guards were close, judging how my fellow captives would react to an incident. Randall intervened.
"What in the name of the good man is this about?" he shouted, charging between us and standing stiff-legged, arms held up, fists clenched, as if he meant to fight the man himself. "What is this brutishness?"
The tall, stoop-shouldered officer had also seen the brewing confrontation and strode to Randall's side.
"Pardon this, please," he said, his voice soft. "No harm is meant, no harm is meant."
Thus soothing and separating us, the incident was brought to an end, and we were divided peacefully enough and led through different doors around the compound. Shirla and I were separated, but there was nothing we could practically do other than provoke another incident, which I felt we would not be able to conclude in our favor. Shirla looked at me, eyes wide, then swung her head away abruptly, and walked with her group of women through a narrow Xyla door. I could not tell whether she felt betrayed or simply had resigned herself to whatever was going to happen. She hated confinement. I dreaded the prospect myself. The rooms within the gray brick buildings were uniform, four on the ground floor and I presumed four on the upper floor, accessible through a stairwell rising from the middle to the rear. Each room was equipped with a single small square window, two double bunks, a table, and chairs. They smelled clean enough, but the sanitary facilities were primitive. A hole in the floor in one corner, a single tap for water that also served to flush the hole.
"You won't be here for more than a few hours," the thick-faced guard said. He closed the door on Salap, a steward named Rissen, myself, and a young sailor named Cortland.
We settled ourselves as best we could, introduced ourselves, tried to pass the time. Lying in my bunk to doze, I saw something scratched into the bricks of the wall. A crude drawing, a head with round eyes and a downturned mouth, arms and legs sticking out of it, hair in jags. Beside this figure, five crude letters, B-O-B-R-T. We looked for and found other drawings scattered around the room, on the floors or walls.
"Children," the young sailor Cortland said.
Salap let his shoulders droop and lay on his bunk with a sharp expulsion of breath.
"Sir Olmi, I am ashamed," he said.
I shook my head but could not think of anything to say. The hours passed, and it grew dark outside. No one came for us, and no one brought information. A single light bulb came on within the room, casting a dismal, pale pink glow, a sick and depressing color under the circumstances.
"Do you think they're going to kill us?" Rissen asked.
"No," Salap said. Rissen began to fidget on his bunk above mine.
"This is not what I thought would happen," he said. "Not as long as we were with Lenk."
I tried to puzzle the situation through. Either the Bryanists were savages on the order of the worst human history had produced, or we were simply in crude detention until Bryan and Lenk had finished negotiations. I tried to imagine what strengths Lenk would negotiate from. 18. The door opened, and the thick-faced guard watched as a man and a woman in light blue aprons brought four covered plates. The guard was now armed, I saw, a small pistol. We took our plates, and the door was closed. The plates contained a thoroughly cooked green vegetable and a scoop of paste-thick wheat gruel. The light went out. The steward and the young sailor did not notice. They were asleep. Salap gave a little grunt and moved around in the darkness.
"Olmi, are you awake?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Lenk said Bryan had a great secret. Do you think he meant using the Scions as servants?"
"Perhaps."
"Do you know what that implies?"
"I think so," I said.
"It could dwarf the importance of our little skeletons," Salap said. "It changes the way we have to think about the Ikoi."
He lapsed into silence, standing in the middle of the room, facing the dim glow of the square window.
"I am lost," he said. "Everything I knew is turned upside down. All my studies, everything the explorers found or thought they found. Bryan has gone beyond us all."
Salap came closer to my bunk and whispered,
"What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to stay here like you until they come and get us."
"Unless you're from the Hexamon."
"What do you think? That they'd send some sort of superhuman?
You want me to break down the walls and let us escape?
Salep chuckled dryly.
If you were from the Hexamon, would you reveal yourself to Brian or to General Baze?
It could make a significant impression.
This is stupid talk, I said. The disciplinary was crazy. Randall was gullible. I'm no superhuman.
Salep stood. I heard him rubbing his hands together in the dark.
I have no wife and children. No alliance with a family, he said. I have never cared much for family life, but I have always taken care of my researchers, my assistants, my students.
I failed.
We're all helpless, I said.
You don't get my meaning. I have always seen a single bright thread of destiny stretching ahead of me, and I felt those around me would be safe as long as that thread stretched taut.
We're not dead yet, I said, finding this line of talk no more useful than the last.
I have never known what to think of the good Lenk, Salep said. When we followed him here, he seemed all-knowing, very thorough. But he has not handled the factions well. So much rancor, so little resolve. Unwilling to crack heads, I believe.
You think he should have cracked a few heads?
I think he should have been prepared to do what needed to be done, ready for what happened.
Perhaps the dream is over for Lenk.
Cortland stirred and poked his head over the edge of the bunk.
Have some courage, he said in a harsh whisper. Don't speculate about things you can't know.
Brian may be in for a surprise.
What kind of surprise? I asked, suddenly intensely curious. The situation had been entirely too simple, when history demanded that it should be complex and dynamic.
I'm just a sailor. I don't know much of anything. But Lenk never plays from weakness.
Salep made a small chuff of disbelief.
Let him surprise me. I will be in his debt even more.
We're all in his debt, Cortland said with little boy confidence.
He took us from Thistledown. General Baze doesn't know everything.
You were born here, Salep said.
You never saw Thistledown. How old were you when you came here?
20, Salep said.
And you?
The sailor asked, aiming his voice in the dark to where I sat on the lower bunk.
I was born here, I said. I never saw Thistledown. I've read about it.
Salep said nothing.
I never liked hearing stories about Thistledown, Cortland said.
Too much for any human to think about.
And Lamarckia is not? I asked, chuckling.
Lamarckia is like Lenk, the sailor said.
Benevolent but full of surprises.
The green, Salep said.
Yeah, Cortland said.
Why green?
Salep did not answer.
Rissen, the steward, snored on.
I dozed a few hours and came awake just before morning. Through the window I saw a reddish natural stone surface mottled with drooping dark green shapes like melted fern fronds. Banging noises in the courtyard of the compound awoke Salep, Rissen, and Cortland. They used the meager facilities, and we stood expectantly near the door, awaiting breakfast, freedom, or whatever might present itself. The thick-faced guard opened the door and waved us outside. We stood blinking and stretching in the brightness, watching others emerge from the doors around the courtyard. Salep adjusted his long shirt and pants, saw me observing him, and smiled at his pretensions. Tables had been set up in the center of the courtyard. Shirla stood by one, and I glanced at the guards who seemed to have their attention on other matters, conferring with more servers in blue aprons or counting the people coming through the doors. I walked across the stone floor of the compound and hugged Shirla. Not a comfortable night, she said, clinging to me.
With a small shudder, she let me go and looked around the courtyard, lips pressed tightly together.
But we aren't dead. This seems to be breakfast.
Servers brought plates on rolling carts and food in big ceramic bowls. Randall, his stiff brown hair awry, sat at the table across from Shirla and me. We were served more greens and gruel. The guards stood back as if we were not important, or perhaps not even there. All were armed. Randall ate his serving in silence, staring at nothing in particular. Shirla spoke about the accommodations, no different from ours, and then asked,
"I see Salep, but where's Shadro?"
"Not here," Randall said.
"Why?"
Said he had something to tell Brian. The guard let him out last night. Randall gazed at me over a poised spoon.
He's going to tell them about you.
Shirla turned and asked,
What about you?
I frowned and shook my head in disgust. A stupid story, I said. Randall focused on nothing again. The stoop-shouldered officer walked to the northern side of the compound, followed by another guard carrying a small crate. The guard placed the crate on the ground, and the officer stepped onto it, shifting one of the odd curved batons from hand to hand. The thicket above and behind the western buildings of the compound glowed brilliant gold-green in the morning sun. All around the compound, a distant whirring alternated with faint, high-speed chuckle-ducks, the first sound I had heard that seemed to come from the ECOS. "Hello," the officer said to the assembly around the tables. He shifted his weight from one leg to the other, clutching the baton in both hands now, ill at ease. "I realize this part of your visit has been a little boring, but I hope you understand. I can tell you that talks between Sir Abel and Sir Brian have been going well." He stopped here, and we glanced at each other, clearly not feeling much encouraged. "There is no danger. Our manner may seem harsh, but we mean no harm. We have reacted to very difficult circumstances with increased resolve and order. You should not believe all those stories, those things that we have been accused of." This awkward phrasing seemed to irritate him, and he drew his eyebrows together, slipped the stick into a loop in his coat, and clasped his hands before him. "Now that you've finished your meal, we will clear the tables, and you will..." He conferred with the guard, who whispered in his ear. "You will gather in a single group in this corner of the compound." He withdrew the stick again and used it to point to the northwestern corner.
"What the hell is that?" Sherla asked. "A whip?"
"Looks like a thin boomerang," said an older woman AB beside her.
"So, please, let us begin," the officer concluded. Then, as an afterthought, "My name is Pitt. Suleiman Ab Pitt. Your host attendants will answer individual questions."
Sherla's concern of the night before had dissolved into quiet contempt. "What a cargo," she muttered. "They think we're idiots."
All around, with fatuous smiles, the guards urged us to our feet, and we followed them to a broad double door at the far end of the courtyard, still in shadow. Brian must have had some reason for subjecting newcomers to this passage through door after door, I thought, but none came to mind. My old cynicism returned in force. Nothing made sense. I tried to keep my mind blank. The only positive in this personal cloud of negative emotions was Sherla's closeness. It seemed that through her I could attach myself to the simple fact of being human. However much bad examples came to mind, she countered them. But Sherla was not in an optimistic frame of mind either. We followed the stoop-shouldered officer, Pitt, surrounded by guards, through the broad door, four and five abreast, and came to a flat green space on the other side. For a moment my eyes refused to believe, but then I saw it for what it was. A well-manicured lawn, covering perhaps 50 acres. Trees, terrestrial varieties, oaks, maples, elms, rose all around, throwing their shadows through a rising patchy ground mist. At the borders of this garden, intensely green thicket rose in a tortured wall to a height of 20 meters, casting its own shadow over the grass. The guards encouraged us to walk onto the lawn. Salep bent down and touched the grass, and across the 9 or 10 meters between us his eyes met mine. He seemed now always to seek out my face when confronted by the unexpected, as if I might explain things to him. But he called out, "Not grass!" Sherla's shoulders trembled, and she shivered all over as if touched by a ghost.
"I've never seen grass," she said.
"We didn't bring this kind of grass with us," Randall said. The sailors and other members of the crews stood like sheep on this unexpected sward, uncertain what was expected of them. "Brian shows you the beauties of the world he foresees," Pitt called out. The role of master of ceremonies did not suit him. His eyes remained flinty, his shoulders drawn down, no matter how broad his smile and generous his tone. "We have formed an alliance with the ECOS, and it works with us, for us." Salep shook his head, still disbelieving. One by one, embarrassed but gaining in courage, the crews kneeled and felt the grass or walked over to the nearest trees and touched the apparent bark, the branches and leaves. Not a leaf out of place.
the lawn as perfect as a carpet. I kneeled and touched the blades. They were cool and stiff, much stiffer than the grass I had walked across in parks in Thistledown.